Good morning. So my name is Les Becker, and I'm going to give you the presentation of three functioning models of mobile health in our community. And I'm struck by a bit of irony as I come up here to present to you because, of course, I have my smartphone with me. I have a tablet sitting nicely over there. But, of course, what did I write my most important facts on was a piece of paper, and I don't trust either one of those technologies to not go blank on me while I'm up here, so I have a piece of paper, which is kind of an interesting irony as I start the presentation. So I have a few team members that I want to recognize because they were a part of this presentation. I don't want to stand up here and pretend to you that I did this alone. This was really a departmental effort, and we have two of the members that are up listed in the audience with us. So our director, Dr. Umair Shah, is with us, and our director of veterinary public health, Dr. Michael White, is with us, and both of those gentlemen played a key part in making this possible. So I have no disclosures. That's the easy slide. So the agenda, what are we going to talk about? So from a local public health department's perspective, what are some of the issues and strategies of implementing mobile solutions in the community? I have some examples which relate to veterinary public health for an application called Pet My Pet. Our internal departmental mobile app that we've deployed out to the community to allow access to the community, called our HCFES mobile app. And the disclaimer I'll give you is, like any good public health professional, we've made acronyms out of everything. We are Harris County Public Health and Environmental Services. If I were to use that every time it showed in the slide, I would well exceed my 20 minutes in the first five. So we call ourselves HCFES. So bear with me as we go through. And then a really interesting project, which I think has a lot of benefits that others could use, which is video direct observation therapy for TB patients. And then at the end, we'll open it up for questions for the entire panel. A little bit about Harris County. So we are large, and that's really going to come into play when I start talking about the VDOT application and how it plays in. We like to say that we are the size of Rhode Island from a geographical standpoint. And yesterday in one of the presentations, we actually had someone from Rhode Island who said you're actually also have four times the population within that geography as well. So we thought that was pretty interesting. So I feel like I have permission to say that. That is no disparaging remark against Rhode Island. It is just the size and scope of what we deal with. Within that area, we also have 33 municipalities, which we provide some or all services from a public health perspective. So it makes it a little complicated from a geopolitical standpoint. And then the size of our agency is about 700 professionals, public health professionals, and about an $80 million annual budget. So some issues and strategies. So local health departments are a source and a resource for information. And how many people in here have a website for their public health department? So that's kind of the general way we get information out. Sometimes we do media campaigns, but in some way, as a health department, we are trying to engage the public to give them our messages to make sure they know how to get access to our services. We often have a lot of data that we want to share in some form or fashion, and it's very difficult to get that data out. One of the objects we're going to talk about is the data around food inspections. In our community, we have 8,000 restaurants. That's 8,000 inspection reports that are all online. It's very difficult to weed through that as the citizen and find what you're looking for to help keep you safe. And then, you know, one of the biggest problems for us is kind of we're out of sight and out of mind. So as a health department, how many people think to go to your website very often? We've had great presentations about the why mobile devices are so prevalent today. There's the economy, it's cheaper, it's easier. As a health department, in some ways, we need to transition and start thinking about how can we engage those consumers to give them the health information. As our director often says, there's a window between 20 and 40 where we don't have a lot of interaction with most of the public because they're in the prime of their health from a health department standpoint. We see them when it's too late, when they're in their 40s and they have chronic disease and they have the other elements that are starting to come back into their lives, and that's when we engage them again. That's the exact demographics that my counterparts were talking about that really have accelerated the use of mobile devices. And if you think that generation is going, last night I was watching the news here in Chicago, and there was an article that there was a study in Philadelphia They surveyed underprivileged and low-income individuals in an urban area, almost 400 families that had kids aged 2 and under. In that population base, over half of those kids, 2 and under, used a mobile device, either a tablet or a smartphone, on a daily basis. So I started doing a little more research, and I went back and found some statistics which match up exactly with what they're saying. So from the overall population, about 66% of the population has a smartphone or device that they use regularly. As you move to younger ages, so that 13 to 16 age, it's in the 80%, 85-86%. And even 6 to 9, it's 80-something percent to use a tablet. So the generation that we're coming in and we can really impact love these devices, and they're not giving them up. We're coming online. We're learning to let our paper go a little bit, and we're moving in that general direction. But that population is a great opportunity for health departments to figure out how to engage them with the media that they're used to using. So the first example I want to talk to you about is called Pet My Pet. How many people in the room have pets? Yeah. How many people would be very upset if you lost your pet? Most of you. I won't call out the people that didn't raise their hand. I'm assuming that was their wife or kid's pet that brought them to that determination. As a health department, we have a veterinary public health division. Traditional animal control, we have a shelter. We often get a lot of lost animals in our shelter. And there's two reasons that, from a health department's perspective, we want to get those animals out. Well, it's really three. One is the right thing to do. Two is we want to unite families with a lost or stolen pet, because that's a pet that is affecting your emotional well-being. So we all raise our hand that you'd be upset. That affects your abilities to function, that has stress that's related to it. So as a health department, we can help with that. And then the third is we just need the room. We don't have enough space for the animals. We need to get them returned to their owners. So we teamed up with an enterprise called Pip My Pet. And what they do is they do facial recognition for your pet. Isn't that pretty cool? I don't have the exact percentage. It's 90-some-odd percent accurate when you get your pet's picture in the system. And what we do is we take the data that we were already collecting in our shelter. So every animal that comes in, we take a picture of it, and in the way that we did it in the past, we uploaded it onto our website, and if someone lost their pet, they could scroll through the pictures that were online, they could try to do a search, and then, of course, if they saw something that matched, they could come into the shelter. With this application, it actually does the recognition and the match. It goes through and scans all those pictures in our database much more effectively than the person. If it thinks that it finds a match, then there are some humans on the back end that actually go back and look and say, well, what demographics did you put in about your animal? It says it's 11 years old. Is this a puppy? It says that it's a female. Is this a male? And does that personal check to say, yes, maybe this is it. And then it sends the notification over to the individual so they can come to the shelter and pick up the animal. And so we were one of the first shelters to partner with this company to put this in place, to set up the data feeds and kind of work out the logistics of how it should and can work. And it's been a real success. To give you a little sense of what it looks like, a visualization of what it looks like, it says Pip and it's got pets, so a cat and a dog. You would go in and load pictures of your animal. You make sure it knows which is the eyes and which is the nose and which is the mouth. And it catalogs that and actually captures that picture and analyzes it, puts it in a data system behind. And then you fill out information about your pet, such as age, where you live, breed, those type of things, so it has some other background information to go off of. And then in the event that you lose your animal, it's got like an Amber Alert system for the dog. So you click the button, and it says, I lost my pet. It starts going out and scanning all those databases, and not just our shelter, but other shelters. It looks for them. And then it'll let you know if it has a match. It also has a social networking component where it will push it out to Facebook and some of the other social networks. And it also monitors those social networks to see if it can find a match on someone that may have uploaded a picture of your animal and said, I found this dog or cat. That's pretty cool, right? It blew me away when they said facial recognitions for dogs, because you kind of think all dogs look the same except for your dogs, which often look like you. You guys ever notice that? It may just be me. Okay. I better move on. There's additional information if you want to learn more about this. Of course, you can go to the Google or Apple store and download. If you search Pet My Pet, it'll come up. They have a website called Pet Recognition to go check it out if you want to load your pet in. They're actually moving across the country. They're in a lot of different shelters in a lot of different places across the country. So I would encourage you to take a look at that as an option for your health department to be able to share the data that you probably already capture if you have an animal control or veterinary public health division in a different way, in a mobile way that engages consumers in a different way, and in the case with pets, in a very emotional way. And the cost of this for us, I think, was less than $1,000 to implement, and really that was just a few database changes on the back end that we needed to make in order to have the data feed work out the way it was supposed to. I think so it's a very economical approach. The second thing is, one of my colleagues said, there's an app for that. Now our health department has an app for that. So we're very proud of our app. And we started out looking at how can we share data that we know consumers are used to getting from us, that the data is in really good form or fashion that we can share confidently. And so we decided to look at food safety and restaurant inspections as an opportunity to launch the app and move it forward. As I said before, our area is large. We have right at 8,000 restaurants that we inspect. That's a lot of restaurants to try to keep up with, which is one of the reasons that moving to a mobile app was a very useful thing for us as far as disseminating the information, because you can do geocoding. You can tell people what's relational to where they are rather than just what we have. And so our approach looked at the geospatial component of it. And what we tried to do is give them the information that you could get onto the website and look for if you knew the restaurants, you knew how to search, what's in that restaurant inspection report in a very tactile way, so I can interact with it, I can play with it, I can get it quickly and easily, which is what this generation is really used to. They don't like reading long reports. They don't want to take the time to dig and search and find the information. The information has to come to them in meaningful ways. And so the app is an approach that we hope does that, so it makes it more useful to the citizen. And then one of the other things we wanted to do is make it a bi-directional component, so that the information that we had was given to the consumer. But boy, if they're in that restaurant and they find a snail, and it's not escargot, in their dinner, that maybe they could send us a picture of that, report it to us, so that we can go out and take a look at that restaurant. Or if they saw rats running across the floor, that they could report that, interact with us really in a live manner. And so food safety was our phase one. Preparedness is going to be our phase two, and I'll show you a picture of the app in just a second. But our goal is to really take all the core services that we do as a health department and integrate them into the app, so that at the end of this process, what the consumer has and our constituents have are an easy way to interact with their health department and get information and give information in a bi-directional way, quickly and easily, on the thing that they're used to using the most, which is the phone or tablet that they have in their hand. And we really think that that is a method that will allow us to engage our population in a much different way than we have in the past and open up a tremendous amount of opportunity. So a little bit about the app, some visuals to help you realize what this is. This is the splash page. It's available in the Android and Apple store for download. We have holders for all of our services that we provide. As I mentioned, food establishments are the first one that we're going to focus on. But we do have the rest kind of mapped out, so we'll be ready to go. And then within the next year, we should have preparedness, mosquito control, and our animal systems online. And then our last piece will be integrating our clinic model so that we can have appointments and appointment reminders for all those safety net services we provide integrated as well. But to focus on the food piece for a moment, if you click on the food button, you'll be taken to a screen that lets you report an issue, search, or find a restaurant. It's on a mobile device, so we wanted to leverage the technology that almost every mobile device has, which is location services. So if you just search nearby, it'll take all the vast 8,000 restaurants and 1,700 square miles and just narrow it down to, hey, what's within 5 or 10 miles of where I am? Or if I know I want to go eat in a particular part of town, or I know the name of the restaurant, I can search by that and just get the results that are important to me and not just the bulk of what the health department has on its website that I have to sort and filter through. We display icons on the screen so that the person can zoom and interact with the data. And then when they find the restaurant that they want to get more information on, they just have to click on it. And when they click on it, it's going to open up and say, well, this restaurant had its last inspection on this date. This restaurant had demerits for this. They didn't have clean paper towels around the sink. They had hot, cold temperature violations, whatever it is. And it's going to give them a sense of what they're looking at. So if they pull that up and it says they had to be shut down because they had cross-contamination food, or there are just so many demerits that you have to keep scrolling, what we're trying to do is empower the consumer to make rational decisions. They may say, well, I love that restaurant anyway. I don't really care what goes on behind the scenes in the kitchen. They got really good food, and they can go with it, eat there. But it's the buyer beware concept, that we've empowered them to make personal decisions for themselves that can affect their health. And that's the direction that we're headed. With the food established, I also said that you can upload a picture and tell them what the complaint was. So the food was contaminated with something, I saw some violation, and one of the features that we built into the application is that that is geocoded. So you can't be the restaurant across the street, take a picture of some not nice looking food, and submit it under a different restaurant. It's going to tell you where the picture was taken and if it was legitimate for that restaurant or not. And then our food inspection folks, our investigators, will go out within 48 hours of getting that complaint in and review the restaurant just to make sure there's nothing else. And what we want to be able to do is respond as quickly as possible to those interactions to give the consumer the confidence that we are protecting them and the public. So this is the report, the complaint. They can tell you what kind of complaint, what they saw, and finally upload a picture. And then the phase that we're about to launch at the first of the year is going to be around preparedness. A big portion of what we do is around preparedness. We, you know, Harris County, Houston, Texas, hurricanes, we get all kinds of natural disasters. We have food outbreaks. We have all kinds of things. And so we're building in the app the ability to transition in an emergency to not operate in that mode that you see in the second slide where it's just got everything the health department does, but really in an emergency response mode that says, what is going to be the information I need about this emergency that I can get to quickly and easily? And again, we think that that is an approach that will allow it, again, to engage that consumer of the information in a way that makes it important to them to be able to work with us. And then the third example that I'll talk about is video direct observation therapy. So how many of the health departments in here do TB services? So the traditional method for doing TB is to use direct observation therapy. So we have DOT workers who get in a car, and 5 out of the 7 days a week, or sometimes 7 days out of the week, they drive to the person's house. They go into their house. They watch them take the medication. They talk to them about symptoms they may be having. They see how they're doing, their general well-being. They get back in their car, and then they go to the next person. Well, and if you think about that size and scope issue, if I told you we're the size of Rhode Island, but we have the population of 4.3 million people who tend to all be on the road at the same time, logistics of sending people across and back and forth around a county that large with a population that high and a traffic problem are enormous. And it really at some point was a financial issue that made us think about doing this in a different way, because if you guys have TB in your departments, if you're anything like us, you're underfunded for the amount of cost it takes to perform TB in your community. So we needed to find a novel way of doing this in the community and maximize the return that we were getting for our investment in the personnel. So I have a finance background, and it's really easy for me to say, well, we were paying these DOT workers this amount of money for these amount of hours, and they also drove this amount of time, which we were doing mileage reimbursement at the time. That's really expensive. There's got to be a cheaper, easier way. From a non-clinician standpoint, it seems really simple to me. You just take a little webcam, put it on the desk, tell them to log in every once in a while, and you're done. The clinicians in the audience or the public health professionals have been doing this a lot longer than I have will tell you, well, that's not really sufficient, that you need to have processes and protocols and procedures in place. And so as we started this process, the technology piece kind of solved itself. But the real difficulty is figuring out how the practice and policies and procedures work so that we still are administering in a quality way, that we're doing all the observation pieces to make sure that our patients are still not having any symptoms, any of the issues that we want to make sure that we're catching on the front end. But in the end, it's a great marriage because it gives the autonomy back to that patient as well as back to the health department. And I think the autonomy piece of it is really important for that person that's at their office and doesn't necessarily want the health department showing up in their car with the health department on the side walking in and giving them meds. Or the person that's at home and our person can only make it to give the medication to them at 8 to 8:30, but yet their life doesn't operate around the health department's schedule. So it gave it back, and we have one of the docs on our team, Dr. Arnar, used the term personalized public health. And I think this app gave us the ability to deliver some personalized public health to our community in a very different way. So we are one of the first entities to do it on a large scale. I know there are a lot of entities that have done it on a one-off, especially in rural areas where you just had to find ways to make this work. But for an important piece to do it in a large scale with this, we wanted to make sure that we were doing it in a HIPAA-compliant manner. And so we looked at things like Skype and all the other services that are out there, and we felt that there were uncertainties that we just couldn't work around, so we found a HIPAA-compliant cloud-based solution. We used a company called Emoca. Emoca is out of Johns Hopkins, and they have a great platform, a great program. It has really worked well for us. There is also another entity that we evaluated out of UC San Diego, Dr. Garfine, and they're doing a lot of great work around this as well. And what I would say about the technology piece is that's probably less important. I think you need to work about how you're going to make this work and how you integrate it in, and then evaluate the technologies that are out there, because this is just coming online, just like a lot of other telehealth components are, and the landscape is going to change dramatically, and you need to just look and see what's available and what makes sense for your health department as you move forward. So the MyDot mobile app is actually downloadable by the Android and Apple store, but we end up giving the patients a phone just because we want to be able to control the environment. So we give them the phone with it preloaded on. They would select it. It just goes through a series of steps for them. It validates the day, asks them a few questions about where are you taking your meds at, or are you at home, or are you outside, or are you in the office, and that helps with some of the calibrations on the app itself about GPS and about lighting and a few other things. And then it gets to the important part. What are some of your symptoms? What are the issues that you may be experiencing that we need to know about? And so they're allowed to check those off. And the important thing to know is if they check off any of these symptoms, then the process stops. It's no longer going to be a video direct observation therapy session. A nurse case manager is going to contact that individual and talk to them, and if need be, we'll send someone out to the house to make sure that everything is okay with them. And that gets to my narrow financial view of the world. I thought, you know, we give observation therapy up to 9 months every day. Well, I'm thinking, okay, we take the camera out on the first day and we pick it up on the last day. But that's not how it really has to work in the real world, because we need that interaction with the patient. We need to give them the meds. And we, somewhere between 2 weeks and 4 weeks, have an interaction, personal interaction, where we're bringing out meds and we're validating that the symptoms are not showing up in the patient, that everything's going okay. So there are those touch points that are built in. And I think as a health department, you'll just have to decide where those touch points work for you. And then they just record a short video of themselves taking the meds. And there's a routine for this. There's actually a script that we give them. We give them a little cell phone holder so it gets the camera in the right angle. They will take the video. The video then gets submitted if they think, okay, I did it correctly. And it gets submitted to our department. And what we do on the back end is have a nurse case manager or a contact investigator watch the video and make sure that everything was okay and that they can confirm that the person took the meds. Sometimes they'll need to call them just to make sure. But in general, that process works pretty smoothly, and we don't have to generally go back and talk to them. For us, this was a kind of a learning process, and we treated it as a project. It took a little over a year, maybe a year and a half, to go all the way from conception, working through the policies, the procedures, how do you do it, how does it interact with the patient, and then how does the technology integrate it. And as a health department, we really think on all these applications that there's an opportunity to share with other health departments. We're not in business to do video direct observation therapy, so we're not trying to make money off this process. And we think that there are ways that we can take the lessons learned in the process we went through and share that with other health departments so that it's easier for maybe small health departments that don't have an $80 million budget and 700 people to figure this out. So we've done a couple of things. There's a link in the slide that takes you to the video. I'm not going to show it for the sake of time, but there's a website that we've set up. Remember I told you we like the term HCFES. We use it in everything. So we, in this term, we use it for a website. So it's hcfesv.org. You can go to that website. We have two things that are related to video. So we have a TED-like. It's not an official TED. It's a TED-like talk that lasts about an hour that talks about our implementation of the project and how it went and our interactions with the patients and what we learned. We also have a short, I think it's about 3-minute video that just gives you the conceptual, what were we trying to do with VDOT, how was it implemented. And then the great part I'm really excited about is we developed a guide. It's about, I think, about 40 pages altogether. It's a guide of here's what we did, here's how we did it, here's the lessons learned, here are the things that you can use in your health department if you want to try to do this. And then it has our contact information as well. And that's all on that website for you to take and use however you would like. So it's hcfes.vdot. And I just want to kind of wrap up by saying these are the examples of the things that we have going on internally, and I think it makes a lot of sense to interact with our community using our mobile devices and this technology. I think as health departments, we're getting better at it and we're learning as we do it. But I think it's an approach that our population base is going to force us into. And it's not going to be long before those 6 and 9 year olds and those 13 to 16 year olds are in the sphere where we need to be acting with them, not through their parents, but in society at large. And it's not quick and easy to do these things. So if we don't start doing them now, we're going to be behind the curve. So I would encourage you and your departments to look at doing this sooner rather than later to move this along and see if it makes sense for you and your communities. So with that, that's the end of my presentation. Thank you. I can have our moderator come up, and then we can answer questions across the spectrum.
That's tricky. That was great. So interesting. Thank you both. Questions? Yes.
Small health department in Connecticut.
Can you?
Small health department in Connecticut. I'm a small health department in Connecticut. So all through the 90s into this century, I was a database builder, and I built applications for the health department for its inspections, for tracking vaccinations, for billing vaccinations, all kinds of stuff. I feel way behind the eight ball now in this. Like, that's all I have to say. It's a question of a statement. I feel way behind like the other end of the public. I never thought of that, or I don't know how to do it. And you have the great video and everything like that for this tuberculosis thing. How much is the app cost? Or is it available?
It is available. Do you want to repeat the question?
Sure, a small public health department. And we're here to help you feel less behind. So the question was, how much does the app cost?
So the app costs probably around $40,000 to $50,000 for a hosting license, but that's again for a large population. We have close to 125 TB cases per year and a large staff that support that, so it's obviously scaled up at that price. We decided to give phones, so there's an added cost for the phones every month. Again, the population size depends on the cost that you're going to associate that with. But I would encourage you, that doesn't mean that the solution we picked is the solution that you have to go with, and that there aren't other cost-effective solutions out there. But until you do the due diligence and you go through, it's hard to quantify what that exact cost would be for a health department, depending on size or depending on which product. My sense is that this is going to get cheaper and cheaper as you go, because there are going to be more and more competitors that enter that market and compete with the EMOCAs and the UC San Diegos as this takes off.
Thank you. Building an app from scratch is an expensive proposition, and that's about right for... Yes, ma'am.
Have you been able to demonstrate...
The question is about demonstrating the cost effectiveness around that.
Yes, so we have done a cost study. We actually were trying to use a one-year period, which for us the year period ended October 1, so it's not finalized. We're showing about a 40% savings over direct observation therapy when you add in mileage, employee time. For us, the employees weren't let go, because we have plenty of TB and plenty of things for them to do. So it was kind of a resource move elsewhere to work on those other issues. But about 40 to 45%. And we'll have final numbers, and those will be posted to that website when we get the analysis complete.
Yes.
We're working with our refill residue population.
Okay, so this is about connecting with low literacy populations and possibly non-English speaking populations using the app. The great thing about an app is that it can be visual and it can also talk to you in any language, and so you don't have to necessarily guide somebody through with text. But maybe is that a consideration for you when you built or implemented these?
It is, and we have a large refugee program. Dr. Haney, our refugee division director, is here as well. And what, I think from a literacy standpoint, it's not just the refugee population, but there's a lot of people that aren't used to using, even if they have phones, aren't used to using the smartphone technology. Our way to overcome that was to engage them in one-on-one training sessions. So when they get the phone, the DOT worker actually sits with them the first time they do it and the second time they do it until they get to a point where we know they're very comfortable learning and using it. But most of them are comfortable with phones. It's just adapting them to understand the process and the way it's supposed to go. And I think for us also looking at separate languages when we are doing our app development, at some point we're going to have to look at doing a Spanish version of the app or a Vietnamese version of the app to engage that segment of the population that would consume it more effectively in that language.
Yes.
How do you deal with the issue, the legal issues, where there might be a breaking confidentiality with your patient? Do they sign a disclosure form beforehand agreeing to that?
Is this about for the app?
The VDOT.
Okay, so for the VDOT app, this is about confidentiality and disclosure for patients.
Yes, we have legal counsel on staff that worked with us through the entire process, and there's a disclosure statement that we have them sign off. And it is because there obviously could be in an open setting, and to make sure that they're aware of their surroundings when they do the video, that's very important.
HIPAA does make allowances for sending information through all of these technology-enabled platforms, so if the patient is okay with it, it's okay to send it.
I will say that on the app itself, the phone doesn't store the videos. So once the video has transmitted successfully, it's actually deleted for the phone, so that if somebody came across that phone, they wouldn't be able to find the videos.
Yes?
I have a question about liability. Do you think there are any differences for practitioners, whether they're meeting with patients sort of telehealth versus in person?
Mm. Well, certainly in my experience at UCSF, those clinicians were terrified.
Yeah, I'm asking that. We were doing a study using teledermoscopy, so patients at high risk for skin cancer. Mm-hmm. But, there's a lot of concern about, not catching something. I don't know if anyone has thought about that.
Do you have any direct experience with that?
None. I think Matt maybe has something in the NetSmart side of things.
Right. I'm not a lawyer, so I won't give out liability advice, but I think, you know, it's really the use of the technology in different ways. There's a lot of things that it can catch. Using the cell phone and high-quality images, you can actually do a lot of analysis with the technology that you wouldn't necessarily capture just by a visual inspection. But you're right, there's always challenges since you don't have the same field of vision that you would have in a face-to-face setting. But I haven't come across any of the liability issues on that side. It's just more about the use of the technology, the policies and procedures that you have built around the use of that technology that matter most.